We're good.
We'll go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session on Wednesday, April 18th, 2026, to consider the matter entitled Juan DiPaolo versus U.S. Steel Corporation, docket number LAKE 2023-0202-DM. Present are me, Chair Rakovich, Commissioner Jordan, Commissioner Baker, and Commissioner Marvin. And we'll start with an overview of the case by Michael Cole. Mike, take it away.
All right. Good morning, Chair and Commissioners. This discrimination proceeding arises under Section 105C3 of the Mine Act. It involves the complainant, Juan DiPaolo, and the operator, United States Steel Corporation. This case centers around a discrimination complaint brought by Paolo against the operator. The proceeding arises from an incident that occurred on February 26, 2023. On that day, at the end of her shift, Paolo was struck by a coworker's bag in a hallway near the shift manager's office. Paolo then entered the office doorway and stated words to the effect of, "Did anybody just see that?" and she referenced being hit. The following morning, Paolo texted the union president stating that the blow had twisted the pins in her hip and that she had iced it. The union president informed labor relations representative Nicole Koski on February 28th. Now, the operator concluded that Paolo had violated safety rules 1.7 and 1.8, which require employees to report incidents and injuries to a supervisor, quote unquote, as soon as possible. Paolo was on a last chance agreement at this time, whereby she had agreed and understood that her failure to follow any plant or corporate rules, policies, or procedures would be a material violation of the agreement and result in suspension subject to discharge. On March 7th, 2023, Paolo received discipline notices, and on March 13th, 2023, she was discharged for violating the safety rules and breaching her last chance agreement. The judge held a hearing and concluded that Paolo had failed to prove that her protected activity motivated the discipline and discharge. In his decision, the judge concluded that the operator had knowledge of Paolo's protected activity, that the operator had animus towards Paolo because it dismissed previous reports of physical altercations that Paolo had raised, and that there was a coincidence in time between Paolo's second occurrence of protected activity on March 2nd and her termination on March 13th. Importantly, however, the judge did not find that the operator exhibited animus towards the February 26th communication or the March 2nd official injury report itself. Furthermore, the judge concluded that there was no evidence that Paolo had suffered any disparate treatment, as the judge found that Paolo failed to show that she had been treated inconsistently compared to other employees. The judge held that Paolo failed to establish a prima facie case because Paolo had a responsibility to perform her workplace injury, to report her workplace injury consistent with the employer's policy. Specifically, as part of his prima facie case analysis, the judge concluded that the operator had a legitimate policy requiring its employee to timely report workplace injuries and workplace incidents, and that Paolo had violated that policy and was subsequently terminated under her last chance agreement. Paolo raises four principal arguments on appeal. She argues that the judge misframed the inquiry by focusing on whether U.S. Steel had appropriate grounds to discipline Paolo rather than on discriminatory motivation. Secondly, Paolo contends that the judge erred in failing to credit her report through the union precedent as satisfying the as soon as possible requirement. Third, she asserts that the judge failed to properly consider evidence of animus arising from the prior safety incidents involving the complainant. And finally, Paolo argues that the judge erred in upholding discipline for Paolo's report that would have been timely under Minnesota law. The operator maintains that the judge properly applied commission precedent and that substantial evidence supports the judge's decision. With that said, I'm happy to take any questions.
All right, now.
Well, thanks for that summary.
Thank you.
And Commissioner Baker is volunteered to go first, so have at it.
All right, so I guess I'll just sort of go through the analysis of discrimination complaint and start with sort of the way it we have a prima facie case. If that is demonstrated, then the operator has an opportunity to demonstrate an affirmative defense or to demonstrate that the minor did not engage in any protected activity. If they are able to demonstrate that, and I believe the burden there is a burden of persuasion on the operator. If they have that, then the burden shifts back to the minor to prove that this justification was a pretext. I think in looking at the ALJ's decision, what struck me the most is I think that he got the affirmative defense mixed up with the prima facie case. So I think that the first thing to say is that in this case, the ALJ found that there was protected activity, that there was an adverse employment action, and then found that there was no connection between the adverse employment action and the adverse employment action and the protected activity. In finding that, he went through the circumstantial indicia that we sort of go through in these cases. There was coincidence in time. There was knowledge on the part of the operator of the minor's protected activity. And in addition, the ALJ affirmatively found that there had been animus towards this particular minor's safety complaints about being struck by a coworker in the past. Then, in analyzing whether or not those circumstantial indicia equal a prima facie case, I didn't find that the analysis really connected there. It had all of those elements, and then the judge didn't explain how he reached the conclusion that those elements don't amount to a prima facie case. Instead, he started talking about their justification for discharging Paolo, which really goes to an affirmative defense. They're saying they had a legitimate reason for doing it that was unrelated to her protected activity. I understand the implication that the operator didn't have animus towards her February 27th complaint about her coworker striking her, but given the chain of conduct that the operator engaged in ignoring her previous complaints, I found that the judge's lack of an explanation as to why he believed this one was different was troubling. And put simply, beyond all of this, I mean, if this, the conduct for which this minor was discharged was a safety complaint. If she had not made a safety complaint, she would not have been discharged. And therefore, I think there's no way of finding that there is not a prima facie case here. So I would find that the judge erred in finding that there was no prima facie case. What's the remedy for that? I think depends on what we want to do, with the rest of the analysis that the ALJ didn't go through. I think it's possible there that what the solution is then to say there, as a matter of law, there was a prima facie case established by the facts in this case and remand to the judge to analyze the rest. However, the judge did do a lot of analysis that amounted to an affirmative defense analysis, and so maybe we just shift that analysis over and look, all right, well, did the operator prove an affirmative defense that they, they discharged this minor, for a legitimate reason? I don't have my mind made up on that, but I want to give some thoughts about what I think about the possible affirmative defense. The operator's claim is that she should have made her safety complaint as soon as possible, because that's what is stated in rule, I can't remember if it's rule 1.8 or 1.7, or maybe it's both of them, that says that the operator's rule 1.7 and 1.8. However, nobody can really give a definition, any sort of objective standard or past practice or anything that can demonstrate exactly what that is. What does it mean to do this as soon as possible? And I found that if there isn't, then you kind of have to consider, what would a reasonable minor familiar with, the policies of the Mine Act, the policies of this operator. What would they think that that means? And that's the first question. The second question is, who can she make these complaints to? Within a few hours, really, of her feeling her foot go numb, the sort of event that the operator claims should have tipped her off that she should make her complaint, within a couple of hours of that, she had made a complaint to her collective bargaining representative, the president of the union. Now, the rule says that she's required to make these reports to management. Obviously, a union representative isn't management, but the purpose of a union rep is to communicate with the operator on behalf of the employees. Is that not a reasonable conclusion that she could reach in informing her collective bargaining representative that they would take that to management? And in fact, the union representative did do that. So, you know, I'm not sure if we get into an affirmative defense that the operators actually demonstrated that the miner here has actually violated this rule. And further, you know, moving forward onto pretext, if we were to find that the operator did demonstrate an affirmative defense, I think there's some evidence here that would support a finding that would be pretextual, in that the operator had determined that the had placed the miner on to suspension before it had conducted its investigation into whether or not she had been injured, and then in conducting its investigation determined that there wasn't enough evidence to find that she had actually been struck by another employee, which is the only thing that she is claiming could have caused her injury. So they find that she couldn't have been injured, but fire her for not making a safety complaint in an investigation that occurred after they'd already decided to punish her. So maybe we should not be parsing those second parts, the affirmative defense and the pretext. Maybe the answer is to say there was a prima facie case here, and then let the judge go back and I don't know, either go through the evidence further or get new evidence. I'm not sure what we would do with that, but I'm not certain on that. I would vote now, however, that there was a prima facie case and the judge erred in finding there wasn't. So that's my position right now.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Marvin.
Thank you. And thank you, Michael and OGC, for the memo. It was very useful. These are just my preliminary thoughts on the matter, but I generally agree with Commissioner Baker's analysis of the prima facie case, and I think commission precedent really supports that. I mean, in case after case, you know, most recently in Hargis and Cook v. Rockwell, the commission says that knowledge and coincidence in time is enough. So, you know, the animus and disparate treatment aren't really necessary. I think they're present here based on the judge's findings, but they're not necessary for it. So I was similarly sort of confused in reading the judge's decision where, I mean, taking out the parts of the affirmative defense that he kind of put in the prima facie analysis, I kept expecting him to find a prima facie case, but then concluded there wasn't one, and I didn't quite see the reason for it. So I do think the judge erred there. Then, you know, with regards to the affirmative defense, you know, my understanding is that it has to be a legitimate business reason, and, you know, the burden goes to the operator to prove that. And here, that, you know, they say that she violated rules 1.7 and 1.8, and I think it's important to kind of read those rules closely. And they do say that, you know, you as soon as possible, you have to report to your supervisor. Now, in the hearing and the judge's findings, they say that, you know, that those reports, you know, quoting from the judge's decision, could be made to a supervisor in any manner, including in person, by radio, phone, text, email, etc. So her going into Hunt's office, where her supervisor and three other members of management, I believe, were there, and saying, you know, did you see that? I'm sick of being, like, she just shoved me, I'm sick of this, something to that effect. To me, that feels like it satisfies Rule 1.7. She did you see that? I don't think is a very important thing. It seems like someone where the operator said, like, well, how could they see it? There was a wall. I took that to be a bit of a rhetorical statement of frustration. But, you know, she said that, you know, she struck me. I don't think it's necessary to identify the exact person and those statements. I mean, if you say something fell on me, I don't think that's not a report because you didn't identify what fell on you. The fact is you mentioned an incident. And I think a hazardous exposure of workplace violence. I know the operator's witnesses said that, you know, they didn't quite know what she was talking about. They heard the word hit, struck, bag, but they still didn't say anything. I mean, they didn't respond. They didn't ask a follow-up question. And based on the fact that she's made multiple reports of exactly this nature, including one 2 weeks prior, and, you know, at one point her supervisor laughed it off, it seemed like a reasonable thing to just walk away when they said nothing. So I think that would in itself probably satisfy Rule 1.7, 1.8 to, as soon as possible, report it. It was at the end of her shift. It happened immediately. She said as much. She reported the incident and the hazardous exposure in a manner that was succinct, but, I mean, I think was enough to ask a follow-up, and none was asked. I know that afterwards she said that she felt some numbness in her foot, but she testified, and the judge credited her that, you know, she was on her feet for 12 hours. She has hip pains, back pains, knee pains. She didn't know what it was from, and it wasn't until the middle of the night that she really felt like she went through her usual treatment of ice and physical therapy, and it wasn't until in the middle of the night that she felt more pain. And it seems that early in the morning, she texts her union representative, and on this point, I agree with Commissioner Baker as well, which is that this is a reasonable way to report something to your supervisor. Your union rep is your representative to deal with management. And, you know, she said what happened, and, you know, he said he'd deal with it. And then he did. The next day, less than 48 hours later, he goes to the mine, informs Koski of this, shows her the text, and he asks her if she wanted, Bonch asked Koski if she wanted him to take any action, and she said she was unsure at the moment. And Bonch replied, make a call or I'll deal with it. So again, you know, I know the operator said he just held up her phone, but, you know, he did show her the message. She recalled that it said things like struck and pain and, you know, and he did ask her, what else can I do? And she said, I don't know at the moment. So she didn't ask anything more of them. Again, I think the, you know, when you make these kind of reports, the operator has some burden to do something. You can't just be silent and then complain that, you know, well, they didn't give you enough information. And it wasn't even until after that that, you know, Palo even asked her union rep, well, is this a reportable injury because it's an old injury, which they already know about, or is it a new injury? And, you know, her union rep kind of indicated, well, it's probably an old injury unless you made a report. So, you know, she left it at that. And all this happened before her next shift. So I think when we look at as soon as possible, you know, I think it's important to keep that in mind that, you know, she immediately makes a report to her supervisor in the office. She then reports it to her union rep, who conveys that to my management, you know, within 48 hours of the incident. And, you know, I think a little more than 24 hours after she thinks it's probably an injury of some sort, that she feels pain, that she can, you know, probably reasonably assume is more than just standing on her feet for 12 hours, but was caused by the bag. So, you know, when they say that it can be made by any manner, I don't see how, and including text, I don't see how sending the text to your union rep who shows it to your supervisor or my management is, you know, insufficient. And I try to engage the operator's counsel on that. And, you know, the purpose of the rules was that so they could, you know, prevent this from happening again, you know, if there's an accident or any kind of injury, and then also for reporting purposes. I don't see how this method of, you know, less than 48 hours for a union rep making that report prevents either of those two, especially considering, you know, the way that they analyzed her supervisor's responsibility to report the violence to security and saying, well, the purpose of that was to stop it, and it already stopped, so we have to look at the purposes of these rules and analyzing whether there's a violation. And in dealing with them, there wasn't a violation because it didn't hinder the purpose of the rule. So, you know, if we keep going on the timeline, Paolo has her first shift back. Well, I guess before that, Koski has enough information that she begins an investigation. So I do think that shows that management had what they needed to begin an investigation. She started making calls. She started looking at, you know, the worker logs on what hours they were there. I believe she reached out to Hunt. And so, you know, it does seem like they had enough to begin. At Paolo's next shift, which is, you know, 3 days later, I believe, or senior manager Weir is at the mine, and she's aware of the incident, and she just chose not to have a discussion with Paolo about it. In the judge's decision, she admits that it was probably, she probably should have talked to her sooner, but she didn't. So again, I mean, I believe Paolo made enough of a report that they could have followed up. They didn't. And then at her next shift, she arrives on at the night shift and is told that the following morning there'll be a meeting on March 2nd. And, you know, Koski says that she didn't stay late to talk to her at the beginning of her shift. She doesn't quite know why, but she decided to just come in the next morning and speak to her. So when the operator kept emphasizing that it wasn't until 4 days later, which by my math was like about 3.5 days after the incident and less than that after her being aware there's a injury, it does seem like the operator passed up many opportunities to talk to her. They could have talked to her at the beginning of her shift, which would have bumped it up 12 hours, made it 3 days. They could have talked to her the day before when they were there and knew about it. They chose not to. They could have responded when the union rep showed the text and he asked, do you need anything else? And they said, I don't know, not at this moment. And so, you know, I do think that you know, Paolo met the basics of the safety rule. I mean, it's a vague rule. It's as soon as possible. I think making those reports, you know, in a concise manner right after it happens to your union rep and having them convey it all before your next shift seems to qualify as a reasonable interpretation of that. So all of this to say, I don't think we need to get into pretext. I think that the evidence shows that, you know, she didn't violate the safety rules, and I don't think a pretext analysis is necessary. I think we could find it on the facts of this case, and therefore, you know, there was no violation of the last chance agreement, and I would reverse the judge. And again, these are my preliminary thoughts, you know, based on what Commissioner Jordan and you say, and, you know.
Commissioner Jordan.
I also thank OGC for the memo. I would reverse the judge's finding of no violation of 105C, and I would remand the matter for hearing on the amount of damages, and here's why. The judge, I concur with my two colleagues who've spoken already. The judge erred in his, almost the last sentence, you know, of his decision. She failed to make a prima facie case. She did make a prima facie case, as my colleagues have pointed out. Prima facie case, there was evidence of protected activity. In fact, there was a stipulation. She engaged in protected activity with her report. She suffered adverse action. She was discharged. There was very close proximity in time between those two events, and management, of course, was aware of the protected activity. Those criteria have been held to be enough that one could conclude that there was a violation of 105C. So that was an error of the judge. Then, under a usual analysis, once the plaintiff makes out a prima facie case, the burden shifts to the operator to come forth and submit enough evidence to show that she was fired for legitimate business justification. So what do we have here? Okay, their business justification is that, well, the rule requires you make your report as soon as possible, and she failed to comply with that, so justifies, you know, discharge. So when you start breaking that down, their claim she didn't make the complaint soon enough. I mean, my colleagues have already sort of run through the timeline, but as soon as the incident happened, she popped into the office with a management official present, two other employees present, with, you know, the reaction, did you see that? You know, I just got hit, at, you know, enough to, they kind of realized, well, something happened. They didn't follow up on it, but whatever, at least, you know, she kind of did that initial step. So that was at the end of her shift, which we learned, I learned in all of my, that was a day shift. So let's say that's kind of 5 o'clock, you know, that's Sunday evening on the 26th of February. By the next morning, 10 o'clock the next morning, she's notified the union rep. And let's take a look at that for a minute. I think there's a plausible argument to be made that that should actually bring her within the coverage of the company's regulation, that that should be considered the appropriate notice. And here's why. I think that, as my colleague pointed out, I mean, the union rep, their role is to be, you know, the spokesperson, convey communications from employees. There is, you know, a case, and people can look at it, I'm sort of toying, you know, with whether it might provide some support, but the 1969 Act, the corollary provision for providing protection against discrimination, the language of that statute said you had to make a report to the secretary. And, you know, a case arose, Minor Phillips. He had a complaint, a safety complaint, which he spoke to his foreman at the mine and his safety committeeman. He did not go make an official report to the secretary. He was fired. I think the lower level, at that point, it was still even the Interior Board of Mine Operations. Board, yeah. And he, you know, I think one or the other, either the judge or the board, you know, ruled against him and kind of looked at it. That says secretary. That statute says secretary. You didn't make a report to the secretary. You know, when it got to the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, they kind of looked at it and said, well, given the purpose of the statute, you know, they want to encourage people to make these reports. And looking at the reality of the situation of how things work at the mine, people do. The sort of chain of communication is they talk to the safety committeeman, and that's kind of how it works to get the safety report to the secretary, which is what the statute requires. So we're going to hold those initial reports to the, you know, the other officials are enough to bring the miner under the protection of, I think in that point of time it was, you know, 110A or B of the statute. So I just feel like there is sort of a an understanding that could be appropriately applied here, that okay, their rule says report it to management, but by the next morning, less than 24 hours later, she was sort of making a report. It was to the safety committeeman, you know. I mean, it was to her, well, her union official. So next, the union official, the next afternoon, and was still, like my colleague pointed out, it's not even 48 hours that have passed yet. He's on the phone with Koski. You know, he conveys the report of the incident to the management official. Management official hears that, and apparently it's enough for her to then go begin investigating, looking into it. So, but company still is sort of saying, not enough, not enough, not enough. Steps. I guess the only thing they consider enough is the next day after there's been all this chain of communication happening, and the management official is already interviewing Hunt and everybody to find out, you know, what happened. They finally sort of agree, like, oh, this is the official report, where they're all at a meeting and she's filling out, you know, a written incident report, which apparently there was some question where they had to even kind of insist on getting the piece of paper they needed to make the official report. So we have that evidence, everybody here is, you know, kind of laid out, is enough for me to say, well, their proffered business justification is pretextual. I mean, it's just, you know, nothing was good enough, and it just kind of flies in the face of any kind of reasonable conclusion. And to hold that that construction of their rule, which says make your complaint as soon as possible, would, I believe, act as a deterrent for people making complaints. I mean, I have to think that the rest of the workforce, who is no doubt aware of the history of animosity between these two employees, and that Ms. Paolo has suffered prior incidents from this employee, you know, of violence, workplace violence, they're going to turn around and learn the latest incident led not to any discipline against the other employee that we know about. Paolo gets fired. Whoa, you know, I think I'll think twice before I, you know, convey to management any accident or injury that I'm supposed to convey to them, because it's like, if they don't like who I talk to, for if I don't like, if it's not soon enough, even though I'm not even back at work yet, I'm supposed to, you know, call them on my shift off. And if I'm not sure if it's related to work, they're going to challenge my understanding. It's like, no, you should have, you knew right away it was related to, you know, there's all these kind of loopholes that this, to allow this to suffice for management, you know, making out their business justification, I think would be, you know, very problematic and contrary to the purposes of the Act. And really, at bottom, as Commissioner Baker pointed out, I mean, you have to sit and say, well, you know, at least some courts have said, well, to prove a violation of 105C, you have to show protected activity and you have to show an adverse action, and then you need to ask the question, are you able to say, but for that protected activity, you wouldn't have suffered the adverse action? Well, here, I mean, you have to conclude, if Ms. Paolo had never said anything, kept her mouth shut, I mean, I think they, you know, she wouldn't be fired. So I would conclude that there's not substantial evidence for in this record for one to conclude that, you know, there was a legitimate business justification of the not quick enough report to be the reason that they fired her. And so therefore, I wouldn't remand, because I feel like the record in front of us would only allow, it would not allow you to make the conclusion that that was the legitimate reason. And so therefore, I would reverse and remand for hearing on the damages.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Well, you know, the judge here properly applied the Pasula-Robinette framework. This is Eighth Circuit, it's not Ninth Circuit, so we're not dealing with a but-for test. I would argue that it probably suffices here from what I'm going to say, but nevertheless, I think the judge focused on the wrong step of that framework, Pasula. Under Pasula, the complainant has to establish a prima facie case by proving that adverse action was motivated in any way by this protected activity. Now, the operator can then affirmatively defend by proving that it would have taken that action no matter what. As a preliminary matter on the protected activity, counsel for Paulo argued that she was disciplined for making a protected report to her union rep, and that was the protected activity. Well, in my view, she wasn't. She was disciplined for not timely reporting to a supervisor. Now, critically, she could have done both at the same time, reported to her rep and to the company, and she would have been okay, in my opinion. As for motivation, the judge found that Paulo didn't meet that prima facie case. Now, he found knowledge, coincidence in time, and some hostility, but no disparate treatment, and concluded that she hadn't shown that motivational nexus. But as a side note, we have found coincidence in time alone is sufficient to establish motivation. So I agree with my colleagues. He did err in finding no prima facie case. But the judge didn't stop there. He went on to find that the Paulo failed to comply with the policy requiring that prompt reporting of those injuries. Ultimately, he found no discrimination because she was validly discharged or for to comply with that company policy. Now, to me, that sounds like an affirmative defense. He really didn't say it. I think explicitly, I think that's what we can call it there. But we got to remember here, the yardstick is whether the judge's factual findings were supported by substantial evidence. We can argue all day long here what this case means to us, go through the different facts, how they're applied, this, that, and the other. But did that judge have enough in front of that judge to come to that conclusion? That's really what we're concerned about here. I find that the record does support that implicit finding of an affirmative defense. Ms. Paulo, she was working on a 36-month last chance agreement, and it said that any rule violation, a material breach, is subject to discharge. So this is not a person coming into this situation on reporting to start with. She already had one strike against her, and she knew these rules. She knew what the condition was for that agreement. And the evidence shows that she understood those terms and the consequences. Now, the question of whether she violated the rules 1.7 and 1.8 is, did she do that as soon as possible? That's the language. Now, the judge determined that she didn't report to the supervisor for 4 days. I can see, given all the evidence in front of him, again, substantial evidence, that he could find a violation of the rules in that situation. He reasonably found that her initial, "Did you see that?" was not a report. And being an old mind foreman myself, I remember people coming to me with incidents, horseplay, this, that, and the other. And that's one thing, all right? But when they want to report an injury, that's a different matter. Just as serious, but it's a different matter. So what are we talking about, reporting an incident here or reporting something like an injury that I have to really take some action on as far as the injury is concerned to make sure it doesn't happen again? She reported to the union rep the next day. But this is what I think is key, and we mentioned here. She left it up to the rep to report. In other words, it wasn't her decision. She said, "You do what you think, not what I want." So is she reporting or what? She said, "You do what it is you need to report." And he, obviously, he's not part of the management chain. Now, I know some instances where union reps, when they're in the capacity of a fire boss or something, they could be quasi-supervisors. All right? This wasn't the case here. She didn't think to say anything to her supervisors during that next shift. And ultimately, she didn't report until day 4. Now, she argues what's reasonable. I mentioned this, the 14-day. I don't buy that, the state rule. I don't see that applying here, you know, for a lot of different reasons. But in general, the point of these policies of a reporting rule, let's just look at that to start with, is to remedy the safety concern. That's really why they want that. And you can't wait 14 days to do that. You can't wait 4 days to do that. If there's something that has hurt somebody, you got to jump on it right now, because if it hurts someone else, now we got someone else hurt. And then they have their, as was brought out in oral argument, they have to, the operators, they have to report to MSHA, okay? So you can't really say, and when you ask me, is it vague? I'm not so sure that I would call it vague. Like, what time frame would you put on it? In other words, if you got to report an injury, or you got to jump on something real quick, all right, do I say, well, okay, if you do it within a day? Well, a day may be too long to try to remedy that injury thing. If you say immediately, well, what does that mean? But I think the import here was it needs to be something right there as soon as possible, like right now. Bring it to my attention so I can do something about it. So the non-reporting was the violation. And that violation was the breach of that last chance agreement. Now, I think the evidence introduced did show a legitimate discipline was imposed on other employees that had these last chance agreements. So there's also evidence that they had discipline for reporting related infractions. Now, based on that, the judge didn't find disparate treatment here. And in other words, there was no evidence of that from his findings. Paula argued that the minors were disciplined for failure to report at all, when she's talking similar instances, rather than failure to timely report. And she briefly mentioned that some minors had failed to timely report and they weren't disciplined. But there was no details provided. In other words, what was the situation? Were there injury involved? What were they? So I don't think you can use that as a comparator, for want of a better word here. She does bear the burden of showing pretext. And I don't think that she met that burden here. So the judge made the sufficiently supported findings to establish that affirmative defense. And I initially don't see any need for remand. I would affirm that judge's ruling on different grounds, though. Now, that said, from our discussion here, I'd be open to kicking this back on remand, all right, to clean up the record, because I think we've all talked about what the record says, what it doesn't say, and there's been a lot of what does this mean, what does that mean. I have to think that this thing is going to go up beyond us one way or the other, and I think they need a good record. I would give them the opportunity on a remand to go back and clean some of this up. In other words, answer some of these questions, bring out the evidence in front of the judge, so that they can be, and then the judge can be more explicit in whatever decision comes out. Now that's my two cents, so I'll open it up to anybody.
Can I ask a small point? So I don't know where you fall on this, but you know, they said there was a violation of both rule 1.7 and 1.8.
Yes.
And it sounded like you were focusing on 1.8, the injury reporting.
Yes.
Would you say that when she went into the office, she complied with rule 1.7?
See, I don't think there was enough evidence developed on that.
She reported an incident,
right? She said incident.
Yeah,
right.
So.
Yeah, and they
say report an incident.
Right.
So, I mean, would that be enough?
Well, that's for that, but now we're talking about the injury.
Right, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
I just want to kind of make sure, if we're
trying to. I don't know if that was all that the evidence said.
Yeah.
It looks like it is, all right? But to me, that's not the focus of it, is the injury part.
Right. So, I mean, I guess I just, if we can come to a consensus, I think we should have it narrowed in terms of what we're
looking
for.
Well, we're
saying
it is.
Right. So,
I
just want to make sure that we're then focused on 1.8.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
That was just a small point.
You know, I appreciate what you're saying about, well, sometimes it's appropriate to remand and allow certain things in the record to be clarified, or, you know, to remand, like if the judge applied the wrong analysis or something, like here, apply this analysis to the record and see what you come up with. I am aware, though, that what we have here, you know, we do have a situation where a minor's been discharged. And there's a 105C case, you know, that would involve a lot more extension of time. I mean, and of course, if you really felt it was necessary, then yes, you have to remand in some cases. But, you know, in trying to think, would that be appropriate here? I'm not sure I can bring myself around to that approach.
Understood.
Because one, as I indicated, I think the record has enough evidence that I think you really couldn't reach a decision that would sustain the judge's initial ruling. And so there wouldn't be a point in remanding. It would just simply delay it, and the minor is in a situation of, you know, having been fired out of work. You know, it's that is in my mind too. So I feel like the more appropriate.
See, you're on your end where I am on my end, as far as the evidence. I think we're there. Right. But what I'm saying is, to come to some kind of consensus here, wouldn't it be more appropriate to develop that record a little better? Because I think we point out a lot of things here that's like shot in the dark. It really wasn't developed. It really wasn't. And when I felt like...
Wait, what actually wasn't developed? Let me explain that.
Yeah. When they were talking about, okay, what's the injury, when you're saying who should it be reported? Have they done this in the past? I've never heard that. You know,
have they done what?
They've gone by the rule. What do you say? All we've got here.
Have they fired somebody? You mean in the past?
Yeah. Was it exactly like this? That was never developed. See.
And you know, but how long is?
But I mean, if we.
How long is enough? I mean, that's. I would have loved to have heard more about that. You know, what have they said before? How long is enough?
I mean, if we back up a little bit, though, at one point you said that she was on a last chance agreement. Yeah. She knew the policy.
Right.
1.7, 1.8. She understood those.
Right.
But my read of the record and the case, I'm not talking about the last chance agreement, but the policies, I don't know if she did understand it, because it's like, she didn't know if it was a new injury.
She said she did.
Well, no, but I mean, she didn't know if it was a new injury that was reported. Well, she texted that to her union rep, because there was no indication it was even a new injury. It was just, you know, it was about the pins in her hip and inflammation of it. She didn't, it's not like, you know, everyone is treating it as like when her foot went numb or the next morning she knew there was an injury, but even after that, she's still texting her union rep saying, "Is this? I don't know if this is reportable, if this is a union."
Would it have hurt to report it?
Well, but that's not the issue here. The issue is, was it necessary to report it?
Well, that's true.
Best practices are different than what the rules require.
Understood.
I mean, best practices.
Is it a fireable offense? You know,
yeah.
Do you have to report
and,
it?
And so that's the part, like, you know, and I don't know. I mean, it seems like she tested, like, I don't think any additional evidence would prove when an injury manifested, because this isn't like someone losing a limb or something, or someone getting struck by something, like, you know, that really knocked them out, where you know, okay, that's the injury. She really wasn't sure for quite a period of time.
I have to disagree with you on that. I think she knew exactly what it was. I do.
And where do you find that?
Well, just from the record here.
That's
right. She had all these chances. She knew what it was. This was her second, last chance on this.
Well, but erase that. But I mean, like, in terms of when she was certain it was an injury, that's
right.
Where do you find that in the record?
She was hurt.
But she's always hurt.
But any time when you got an incident like that and it triggers something, all right, it's triggered something. It triggered an injury. That's where I'm coming from. She knew she was hurt. She wasn't hurting before she came up to that in that hallway.
She testified that after every 12-hour shift she was in pain.
Not like this, though.
I don't know if that's accurate.
Well, then that's what I'm saying is, that's what I'm saying is an alternative. Do you want to kick it back and clarify
that? But I think I don't think that's accurate as far as what the judge found, what the record shows.
Well,
I don't think additional evidence.
I'll have to disagree.
Yeah. Okay.
That's where I think we're at.
Yeah.
I think there's enough there. And if this stuff was in front of me as a judge, I think the judge had enough, quite frankly.
Right.
All right.
You know, and it sounds like I sort of threw out there, you know, at the beginning, remand or whatever. Everybody else has said reverse. And you know,
everybody.
I mean,
Not everybody. He's a firm.
Oh, I mean, not reverse. I mean that there's enough on the. There's already enough here to either fully affirm or reverse the judge. So I was the one who was like, whatever. I think it's probably clear from my my presentation of the evidence where I sort of lean on that. What I think is the most likely the right result here. Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about what more we could get. I don't know. I would be interested to see, as you know, where my position is. I'd be interested to see what a reverse decision would look like.
Yeah, that's what I was going to suggest.
And then I could, you know, if I see
out.
That and if I
yeah.
if I'm looking at it in that light, and then I see there's still stuff here that I don't
right
that I feel like I need, you know, because I am leaning towards saying that there's enough here, but there is this sort of nagging thing. Maybe the thing to do is to write this. You both are on reverse,
yeah.
Right? Write that decision, and then I can look at it. And then if I'm, yeah. If I say, oh, that looks, that
so you
looks,
want to be wooed?
And then everybody can buy me lunch, and then
you can decide to go ahead and affirm the judge. Right? You read all of this stuff, so none of this stuff makes sense.
So like similar to the matinee, what we're doing in matinee, where we have two alternatives and we're trying to figure out what looks.
Yeah.
I don't think in the end we're going to end up with a 2-2 on this. I think that if we get that and it looks like it, then I think that we can figure out maybe there's a narrow thing to remand on. You know what I'm saying? Like if I look at your decision, I'm like, this is what we're missing. Then maybe we can craft something that everybody. But alternatively, maybe it's a 3-1, and I say, okay, yeah, actually that reverse decision looks good to me, and then Marco. Yeah. Does that make sense to everybody? I mean,
no, that's what I was already thinking. Like we need to even for me. I mean, I concede that it is a high burden to reverse on the question of substantial evidence, to say there's not enough in the record for a judge to even affirm, when, of course, he's affirming, too. So, you know, for a judge to say that she, violated, that they made their legitimate affirmative defense. It is a high standard to say there's not enough in the record for somebody to reach that conclusion. But I concur in that. I think, you know, there are parts of the record, too, that I have to say, I got a little murky, like the disparate treatment. I think that the complainant, I think that the union, they put evidence in, if I recall, that there were times when the operator accepted injury reports from much longer period than she did here. Even if you say 4 days, there was...
Well, what were the facts around
that? The trouble is the judge said, what were the facts? Because they might have taken that long to figure out they were injured.
Right, that's, yeah.
And then I think in the oral argument, though, then it got murky. Like, I think Hank was saying, well, you know, we had so many incidents of people fired. But I think he was saying, under a last chance agreement, we had all these people filing, and like you were saying, it's blurs the right issue. I mean, it's the last chance agreement. It's not helpful to say we had 10 people fired under a last chance agreement, because it's like, I don't know what they did wrong, you know, and how long they took to tell you, you know, about, did they file their, what happened to them? So that's kind of useless, and I think that was what was being referred to in the oral argument. So I guess what I'm saying is, in the terms of sort of drafting an opinion that concludes reversal, we may be able to sort of get a little clarity on some of these other points, you know, in the record.
I'll say, I think that the last chance agreement's a bit of a red herring. I don't think that really matters all that much.
You still have to find a violation.
Right, because what a last chance agreement does is it places this particular union miner in the same position she would have been in if she was an at-will employee. Any at-will employee can be fired at any time for any reason or no reason at all, as long as it's not an illegal reason. So she was just placed in a position that all the non-union miners that we deal with any time are, if you violate a rule that... where you can be fired for that under the company policy, then you can be fired under it for the company policy. I don't know that gets us... I mean, in that she was then aware that she was an at-will employee, to the point that Marco is making about, oh, you know, she knew she should have, you know, that any violation... I mean, maybe that's relevant in that sense, but being on a last chance agreement doesn't change our analysis at all. It's just another minor who is making a claim of discrimination. I don't really see... I don't see the last chance agreement playing a large role in this one way or the other. I don't think it makes any difference one way or the other.
Right, because if it's a violation of the Mine Act, that's not a fireable offense, whether you're on a last chance agreement or not.
Right, and if it's a legitimate reason, then she might have had a grievance over whether or not this violated the union contract in some way. That's not our concern. It kind of goes both ways. The last chance agreement thing is kind of irrelevant.
Well, it comes at the end. I mean, it has to come. I feel like the judge focused on the beginning, but it's only comes into play if find it a violation of the safety rules and that it wasn't protected.
Right, but yeah. As the, you know, I thought the counsel for Paolo made a good point yesterday. Like, ignore that and say that she wasn't on a last chance agreement and that she was just punished for this. It would still have been a still would have claimed it was a violation of the Mine Act under that situation, because it's not really about, you know, in this case it's more serious for her because she's been discharged, but from her perspective it's a violation of the Mine Act either way. Mm-hmm. So I think I wouldn't even really talk all that much about the ELCA. I don't think it matters.
So we got a way to go. Seriously, I mean, I think we're talking about a way to go, right? Go ahead and write something up and see where we are, right? Write it up, circulate, see where we are. Okay. Have we beat this one enough?
I think so.
All right. Anything else for anybody? Well, in that case, we'll stand adjourned then. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
And thanks,
Mike. Thank you.
Yeah.